Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show on Monday, the 27th of June, 2016. I am Richard Martin, speaking to you from Malaysia, just outside Singapore. Congratulations, Britain! History will remember the 23rd of June 2016 as the day when the British stood strong against the cancer of unmitigated globalist expansion and creeping authoritarian dominion by a cabal of unelected bureaucrats in Brussels. You are but the first of many European Union dominoes to fall in the coming months and years. But it is the very first that always counts the most. Well, it's all over. Britain faced down the lying bureaucrats and social manipulators and voted the United Kingdom out of the European Union. It was a brave decision. There are plenty of scary unknowns, even when you do detach the scaremongering tactics from basic reality. I thought long and hard about what I was going to talk about today in our show, and in the end, I've decided to give some space to the workings of the European Union that the British so carefully avoided. I think you'll find this very interesting. The mainstream doesn't cover it at all, and it's a miracle that Britain seems to have smelled it out without either being informed or being able to deduce it from the limited knowledge that has been made available to them. From a simple trade agreement back in 1975 called the Common Market, the enterprise has morphed into this giant amorphous body of out-of-control bureaucrats that nobody voted for and nobody wants. This is really about globalism, the idea that we should and must be run by bigger and bigger entities until the entire world is controlled by one huge body accountable to no one. I resisted this for a long time, but I have reluctantly come to realize that this is indeed what it's all about. Thursday's Brexit vote may well have marked the spot where the once inevitable march of globalism begins to recede. Ordinary people around the world could easily be seen to have reached the point where real questions about self-determination have become too acute to ignore any longer. Globalism has been championed almost exclusively by political and economic elites. It's been the dominant force in the West for 100 years. World War I and the League of Nations established the framework for multinational military excursions, and at the same time, the creation of the United States Federal Reserve Bank set the stage for the eventual emergence of the US dollar as a worldwide reserve currency. Progressive government programs in Western countries promised a new model for universalism and peace in the aftermath of the destruction of Europe. Human rights, democracy and enlightened social views were now to serve as hallmarks of a post-monarchical Europe and rising US. But globalism never had anything to do with liberal ideology, nor was it intended to by its architects. At its core, globalism has always meant rule by authoritarian elites under the guise of mass democracy. It has always been distinctly anti-democratic and anti-freedom, even as it purported to represent liberation from repressive governments and poverty. Globalism is not, as its supporters claim, simply the inevitable outcome of modern technology applied to communication, trade, and travel. It is not the world getting smaller. It is, in fact, an ideology and worldview that must be imposed by statist and cronyist means. It is the civic religion of people named Clinton, Bush, Blair, Cameron, and Lagarde. The EU, GATT, World Trade Organization, NAFTA, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the whole alphabet soup of trade schemes are wholly illiberal impediments masquerading as real commercial freedom. In fact, true free trade occurs only in the absence of government agreements. The only legislation required is a unilateral one-sentence bill. Country A hereby eliminates all import duties, taxes, and tariffs on all goods imported from country B. And, as Godfrey Bloom explains, the European Union is primarily a customs zone, not a free trade zone. A bureaucracy in Brussels is hardly necessary to enact simple pan-European tariff reductions. It is necessary, however, to begin building what globalism truly demands, a de facto European government, complete with dense regulatory and tax rules, quasi-judicial bodies, a nascent military, and further subordination of national, linguistic, and cultural identities. Which brings us to the Brexit vote, which offered the British far more than simply an opportunity to remove themselves from a doomed European Union political and monetary project. It was the opportunity to forestall the juggernaut and reflect on the current path. It was a chance to fire a shot heard round the world, to challenge the wisdom of the globalism is inevitable narrative. It could be seen to have been the UK's last chance to ask, at a time when even asking is an act of rebellion, the most important political question of our day, or any day: who decides? Ludwig von Mises understood that self-determination is the fundamental goal of liberty, of real liberalism. It's true that libertarians ought not to concern themselves with national sovereignty in the political sense, because governments are not sovereign kings and should never be treated as worthy of determining the course of our lives. But it is also true that the more attenuated the link between an individual and the body purporting to govern him, the less control, self-determination, that individual has. To quote Mises from his 1927 classic Liberalismus: "If it were in any way possible to grant this right of self-determination to every individual person, it would have to be done." End of quote. Ultimately, Brexit was not a referendum on trade, immigration, or the technical rules promulgated by the awful European Parliament. It was a referendum on nationhood, which is a step away from globalism and closer to individual self-determination. Libertarians should view the decentralization and devolution of state power as ever and always a good thing, regardless of the motivations behind such movements. Reducing the size and scope of any single or multinational state's dominion is decidedly healthy for liberty. The British people should be clear about just what they were being asked to vote on at the European Union referendum last Thursday. What does it actually mean to stay in the European Union? What does it mean to exit? Concerning the second question, The dominant issue in the debate has been the question whether there will be a significant negative economic impact on the United Kingdom from exiting the European Union. Prime Minister David Cameron, together with the heads of the IMF, the OECD, and various EU agencies, gave dire warnings that economic growth would drop, the fiscal position would deteriorate, the currency would weaken, and UK exports would decline precipitously. George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, has threatened to cut pensions if pensioners dared to vote for exit. But what are the facts? The conclusion is that this makes no difference to economic growth, and everyone who claims the opposite is not guided by facts. The reason is that economic growth and national income are almost entirely determined by a factor that is decided at home, namely the amount of bank credit created for productive purposes. This has sadly been very small in the UK in recent decades. Thus, much greater economic growth is possible as soon as steps are taken to boost bank credit for productive purposes, irrespective of whether the UK stays in the EU or not, although Brexit will make it much easier to take such policy steps. We should also remember that a much smaller economy like Norway, though more dependent on international trade, fared extremely well after its people rejected EU membership in a referendum in 1995. And by the way, this happened against the dire warnings and threats from its cross-party elites, most of its media, and the united chorus of the heads of international organizations. Besides, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and China never needed European Union membership to move from developing economy status to top industrialized nations within about half a century. The argument of dire economic consequences of Brexit was bogus. Thank God the British people were collectively wise enough to perceive this, even if they didn't understand the implications. As for the first question, namely what it means to stay inside the EU, we should consult the EU itself. Happily, in October 2015, the European Union released a major official report about its key policies and what it plans to achieve in the near future. This report was issued in the names of what they had the effrontery to call the five presidents of the EU. In case you hadn't been aware that there was even a single EU president, let alone five of them, these are the unelected president of the European Central Bank, Goldman Sachs alumnus Mario Draghi, the unelected president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, the unelected Brussels Commissar and President of the Eurogroup, Jeroen Dijsselbloem, the President of the EU Summit, Donald Tusk, and the President of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz. What is the message of this not negligible number of European Union presidents concerning the question of where the EU is going? The title of their joint report is a giveaway. The Five Presidents' Report, Completing Europe's Economic and Monetary Union. The report starts with the frank admission that, quote unquote, with 18 million unemployed in the euro area, a lot more needs to be done to improve economic policies in the EU. Well said. But what exactly needs to be done? And I quote, Europe's Economic and Monetary Union, EMU, today is like a house that was built over decades, but only partially finished. When the storm hit, its walls and roof had to be stabilized quickly. It is now high time to reinforce its foundations and turn it into what EMU was meant to be, to be stabilized quickly. It is now high time to take further steps to complete EMU. End of quote. The central planners in Brussels and at the ECB in Frankfurt are not unaware that under their command, a historically unprecedented economic dislocation has taken place in the EU during the past 10 years, including massive asset and property bubbles, banking crises, and large-scale unemployment in all the periphery countries, with over 50% youth unemployment in Greece, Spain and Portugal, as well as the lack of any serious controls of the EU external borders to prevent an influx of unparalleled numbers of illegal immigrants and economic migrants. However, the EU central planners are in denial about the fact that these problems have been caused entirely by their own misguided and disastrous policies. As a result, they argue that the solution to such problems can only be further concentration of powers into their hands. We need more Europe, as Mrs. Merkel put it. This is what they propose to implement in the coming years by turning all EU members into one single country. So, the Five Presidents' report makes clear that the EU is not simply a free trade area. That project had been left behind with the 1992 Maastricht Treaty, and a very different kind of Europe has become enshrined with the 2007 European Constitution, called Lisbon Treaty, since the people of Europe in several referenda rejected it. Instead, the EU is the project to abandon all national sovereignty and borders within and melt away all European nations that don't succeed in exiting in time into a merged, joint, new, single country with one central European government, centralized European monetary policy, centralized European fiscal policy, centralized European foreign policy, and centralized European regulation, including of financial markets and banking. This United States of Europe, an undemocratic leviathan that the European people never wanted, is the culmination of the much-repeated mantra of ever closer union. This project has been implemented steadily and stealthily over several decades, despite major and consistent policy blunders and scandals involving the central planners. For example, in 1999, the entire European Commission, the unelected government and cabinet of the European superstate resigned in disgrace, as it was found to have taken bribes and engaged in fraud, while the EU's own Court of Auditors has repeatedly refused to sign off the EU's official books. The economics is clear. There is no need to be a member of the EU to thrive economically, and exiting does not have to impact UK economic growth at all. The UK can remain in the European Economic Area, as Norway has done, or simply agree on a trade deal, as Switzerland did, and enjoy free trade, the main intention of European agreements in the eyes of the public. The politics is also clear. The European superstate that has already been formed is not democratic. The so-called European Parliament, unique among parliaments, cannot propose any legislation at all. Laws are all formulated and proposed by the unelected European Commission. As a Russian observer has commented, the European Parliament is a rubber-stamping sham, just like the Soviet Parliament during the days of the Soviet Union, while the unelected government is the European Commission, the Politburo, replete with its commissars. Big business and big banks, as well as central bankers and the IMF, constitute the financial elite that is behind this purposeful concentration of power, giving ever more power into the hands of even fewer people. The undemocratic nature of EU institutions has reacted to such an extent that I have heard of a recently retired member of the ECB Governing Council in private confessing that his biggest worry is the undemocratic nature and extent of the ECB's powers, which have increasingly been abused for political ends. These facts have been drowned out by the constant drip of propaganda emanating from the powerful elites behind the creation of the United States of Europe. During these years and decades of steady transfers of powers and sovereignty from nation states and their democratically elected assemblies to the unelected Brussels bureaucracy, I had always been puzzled by the apparent strong United States support for all this. Whenever the process of ever closer union seemed to have hit an obstacle, a US president, no matter the postholder's name or party affiliation, would intervene and in no uncertain terms tell the troublesome Europeans to get their act together and speed up unification of Europe into one state. Likewise, the British public has recently been told by US President Obama that dropping out of the EU was not a good idea, and they had better vote to stay in. While it is not surprising that the global elite that has benefited from the trend towards concentration of power was getting increasingly hysterical in their attempts to cajole the British public into voting to stay inside the European Union, it is less clear why the US president and his government should have been so keen on the EU project. We had been told in the past by the European media that the concentration of economic and political decision-making in Europe was being engineered in order to create a counterweight against the US dominance. This seemed to motivate some pro-EU voices. Surely the US president must have heard about that. There is another mystery. Just last week, an impressive-looking leaflet was dropped into the letterbox of British householders' homes entitled EU Basics, Your Guide to the Referendum. It was issued by an organisation called the European Movement. The 16-page colour and high-gloss booklet argued for Britain to stay in the EU. Who is this European movement, and who's funding it? This little-known organisation seems financially powerful enough to drop a high-quality print booklet into every household in the entire UK. The declassification of formerly secret records has solved both mysteries. For, as it turns out, they are connected. In the words of Nottingham University academic Richard Aldrich, and I quote, "The use of covert operations for the specific promotion of European unity has attracted little scholarly attention and remains poorly understood. The discreet injection of over $3 million between 1949 and 1960, mostly from US government sources, was central to efforts to drum up mass support for the Schuman Plan, the European Defence Community, and a European Assembly with sovereign powers. This covert contribution never formed less than half the European movement's budget, and after 1952, probably two-thirds. Simultaneously, they sought to undermine the staunch resistance of the British Labour government to federalist ideas. It is also particularly striking that the same small band of senior officials, many of them from the Western intelligence community, which of course means US, were central in supporting the three most important transnational elite groups emerging in the 1950s, the European Movement, the Bilderberg Group, and Jean Monnet's Action Committee for a United States of Europe, ACUE. Finally, at a time when some British anti-federalists saw a continued special relationship with the United States as an alternative to, perhaps even a refuge from, European federalism, it is ironic that some European federalist initiatives should have been sustained with American support. End of quote. UK journalist and former Brussels correspondent Ambrose Evans-Pritchard was the only journalist to report on such academic research findings in two articles in 2000 and 2007. Quote, "Declassified American government documents show that the US intelligence community ran a campaign in the 50s and 60s to build momentum for a united Europe. US intelligence secretly funded the European movement, paying over half its budget. Some of Europe's founding fathers were on the US payroll. The documents confirm suspicions voiced at the time that America was working aggressively behind the scenes to push Britain into a European state." Continuing to quote here, "Lest we forget, the French had to be dragged kicking and screaming to the Federalist signing table in the early 1950s. Eisenhower threatened to cut off Marshall aid unless Paris agreed to kiss and make up with Berlin. Francis Jean Monnet, the EU's mastermind, was viewed as an American agent, as indeed he was. Monnet served as Roosevelt's fixer in Europe during the war and orchestrated the failed US effort to stop de Gaulle taking power. One memorandum, dated July the 26th, 1950, gives instructions for a campaign to promise a fully fledged European Parliament. It is signed by General William J. Donovan, head of the American Wartime Office of Strategic Services, precursor of the CIA. Washington's main tool for shaping the European agenda was the American Committee for a United Europe, created in 1948. The chairman was Donovan, ostensibly a private lawyer by then. The vice chairman was Alan Dulles, the CIA director in the 50s. The board included Walter Bedell Smith, the CIA's first director, and a roster of ex-OSS figures and officials who moved in and out of the CIA. The documents show that the ACUE financed the European movement, the most important federalist organization in the post-war years. In 1958, for example, it provided 53.5% of the movement's funds. The European Youth Campaign, an arm of the European movement, was wholly funded and controlled by Washington. I'm still quoting Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, by the way. "The leaders of the European movement, Rettinger, the visionary Robert Schuman, and the former Belgian Prime Minister Paul-Henri Spaak, were all treated as hired hands by their American sponsors. The US role was handled as a covert operation. ACUE's funding came from the Ford and Rockefeller Foundations, as well as business groups with close ties to the US government. The head of the Ford Foundation, ex-OSS officer Paul Hoffman, doubled as head of ACUE in the late 50s. The State Department also played a role. A memo from the European section dated June the 11th, 1965, advises the Vice President of the European Economic Community, Robert Marjolin, to pursue monetary union by stealth. It recommends suppressing debate until the point at which adoption of such proposals would become virtually inescapable. 50 years after the Treaty of Rome, the architects of post-war US policy would be quite pleased, I think, if they were alive today. End of a phenomenal quote, don't you think? The revelation that the EU is the result of a major US Secret Service operation, effectively just yet another secret creature of deception launched by the CIA, taking seat of honour in the Hall of Infamy that includes false flag operations, invasions, coup d'etats, and the establishment of organisations such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS, solves the third mystery, namely, how on earth the allegedly democratic European nations could design such an undemocratic, virtually dictatorial structure. With the EU and United States of Europe, the US not only achieves its geostrategic goals in Europe, but it has also eliminated the role of pesky national parliaments that could, on occasion, get in the way of US or CIA foreign policy. And another puzzle is solved, namely, why the EU had so readily agreed to a recent US request a few years back that US spy agencies get access to all European emails and telephone calls. A vote to stay in the EU thus can quite clearly be seen as a vote to abolish the United Kingdom as a sovereign state and merge it into the undemocratic United States of Europe, which the European elites are building under US tutelage. The fact that the European public and, it seems, even European politicians have little or no input in key European decisions can be seen from the increasingly aggressive NATO stance against Russia. Brussels-based NATO is the military arm of the European Union, which is overtly under US direct control. This, together with the one-sided sanctions against Russia that the US could simply order the Europeans to implement, causing significant losses in incomes and jobs in Europe while boosting US business interests. Immigration policies are another case in point. If the US had in the past considered the largely homogeneous European populations a source of potential European resistance against its plans for Europe, then the policy to replace them with balkanized failed melting pots also makes sense. Norway voted in 1995 on EU membership. Leading parties were all in favour. Big business and central banks, major media outlets, and the talking heads on TV were frantically bullying and cajoling the Norwegian public to vote in. The people remained steadfast and voted out. Norway did splendidly. And so much more will the UK.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
British voters delivered a savage death blow to the EU corporate superstate on Thursday, sending global markets tumbling and forcing Prime Minister David Cameron to announce his resignation. The narrow victory, which caught the prognosticators by surprise, is the strongest sign yet that working people across the continent are awakening to economic and political disaster that has been created in the name of European integration. Not only has the EU failed to live up to its promise of lifting all boats and widening prosperity, it has also transformed the region into a low-growth, high-unemployment charnel house where bankers and their corporate allies siphon off the wealth of the weaker states to enrich high-flying speculators and voracious bondholders. The referendum represents a critical turning point in the public's attitude towards a thoroughly reactionary and odious institution that is solely responsible for the abysmal state of the economy, the progressive erosion of living standards, and steady rise of right-wing extremism. It's not about Cameron or Nigel Farage or Michael Gove or Boris Johnson. It's about voting for or against the EU, for or against Juncker and Tusk, and five other unelected presidents having a say in one's life. It's about voting to leave or remain in a union that is already dead and preserved only in a zombie state. Brexit is just one vote, and many more will inevitably follow. Brexit is not the first. Grexit had that honour last year. Later this month, elections in Italy and Spain have the potential to turn into preliminary Italexit and Spexit votes. And then there will be more. The reason these things are taking place and will be going forward is that the economies of all these countries are fast deteriorating. The sole reason why people have accepted the rule of Brussels coming from far away over their daily lives is the promise that it would make those lives better and more comfortable. That promise has been shattered. The European Union has made things worse for most Europeans, not improved them. And when seen in that light, why should people agree to continue to be told what to do by those who've made them poorer? There's no democratic model in which that remotely makes sense. There are only undemocratic models left. An economy in decline means the end of centralization and the end of existing political power structures. This is inevitable. The Brexit referendum represents a fundamental rejection of austerity for working people and subsidies for the markets, otherwise known as QE. It is an indictment of the destructive policies that have thrust a broad swath of southern Europe into a permanent depression, while bankers in Paris and Berlin make out like bandits. Even now, the loathsome European Central Bank continues to run up massive debts with ECB QE at $80 billion a month, just to line the pockets of corporate CEOs who offload their toxic bonds with the clear intention of using the money to buy back their own shares, further enriching themselves and their swinish shareholders at the expense of ordinary investors. This Ponzi ripoff is what passes as economic policy in the EU. Brexit threatens to put an end to this huckster's swindle. Brexit is also a rejection of incoherent immigration policies, whose objective is to accommodate the millions of victims of US warmaking in the Middle East. European Union leaders should make every effort, including economic sanctions, to stop Washington from arming and training extremist proxies that are currently fighting in Syria and who have forced roughly 4 million refugees to flee to Europe for safety. Europe shouldn't be blamed for the blowback from America's bloodthirsty foreign policy. Even so, Brussels' unwillingness to stand up to Washington on this matter has allowed radical elements to emerge whose xenophobia is fueling widespread anti-immigrant hysteria. In the US, GOP hopeful Donald Trump has capitalized off anti-immigrant sentiment, making a wall along the Mexico border a central tenet of his platform. Trump issued a statement shortly after the results of the EU referendum were announced. He said, quote, "The people of the United Kingdom have exercised the sacred right of all free peoples. They have declared their independence from the European Union and have voted to reassert control over their own politics, borders, and economy. A Trump administration pledges to strengthen our ties with a free and independent Britain, deepening our bonds in commerce, culture, and mutual defense. The whole world is more peaceful and stable when our two countries and our two peoples are united together, as they will be under a Trump administration." End of quote. The widening of inequality is paralleled by the rise in political extremism, which is hastening the dissolution of the EU superstate and the move towards war. And Britain is just the tip of the iceberg. According to a recent survey by the Pew Research Center, only 38% of people in France have a favorable view of the EU, down from 69% in 2004, which is lower than the level of support in the UK. Similarly, only 47% of the Spanish population holds a favorable view of the EU, down from 80% in 2007. The EU has shown that it is as incapable of reform as it is of accepting responsibility for perpetuating a financial crisis that began 7 years ago and persists to this very day. It has also demonstrated repeatedly that it will not hesitate to inflict as much economic pain as possible on its victims unless they comply with its counterproductive edicts. Worst of all, the strict rules of the EU make it impossible for state representatives to follow the will of their people or to act in a way that serves their own national interests. Any deviation from Brussels' neoliberal consensus is likely to end up before the European Court of Justice, where the mega corporations have the upper hand. By leaving the European Union, Britain will restore its sovereignty and strengthen its democracy. Ambrose Evans Pritchard summed it up like this, quote, "Stripped of distractions, it comes down to an elemental choice, whether to restore the full self-government of this nation or to continue living under a higher supranational regime ruled by a European Council that we do not elect in any meaningful sense and that the British people can never remove, even when it persists in error." End of quote. I honestly and truly couldn't have found words to say it better than that. Hats off to the British voters who had the guts to reject the European Union corporate slave state and cast their ballot for freedom. You're an inspiration to the world. The Remain side was threatening eternal economic damnation and financial Armageddon. Most of the political and media establishment fell into the Remain camp, so this is where the propaganda became painfully obvious. The IMF, for example, published a report recently stating that Britain leaving the EU would lower incomes in the United Kingdom permanently. Really? Permanently? So if voters had chosen to leave the EU, then the UK, which traces its sovereignty back more than 1,000 years and once had an empire so vast they ruled 25% of the surface of the entire world, would never be able to recover forever and ever and ever until the end of time? We're honestly supposed to believe that a few decades within the European Union has irrevocably thwarted Britain's 1,000-year history in being able to achieve economic growth independently? Or that Iceland, not a member of the European Union, can do it, but the UK cannot? Or that a bunch of IMF bureaucrats can see decades, let alone centuries, into the future with 100% certainty? This is such blatant scaremongering. They're not even pretending to be professional and unbiased. And this is direct from one of the top financial agencies in the world. The British government, firmly in the Remain camp, had been using taxpayer funds to support its cause, which is really bizarre when you think about it. If you're British, even if you wanted to vote Leave, the government was using your money to influence your vote in the other direction. One of the most absurd scare tactics has been telling people they'd lose visa-free travel rights to the European continent if the UK left the EU. This is completely absurd. Nicaragua has visa-free travel to Europe. Paraguay has visa-free travel to Europe. Are we really supposed to believe that Brits will be shut off from the continent? They've rolled out every possible threat, every human emotion, every celebrity they can find to influence voters. In fact, these people love democracy so much, they even had Barack Obama fly in to explain to British voters why they should remain in the EU. Because, of course, as we know, Mr. Obama would willingly hand over US sovereignty to a Pan-American political commission based in Mexico City, right? Whichever side was destined to win, it's clear that no one in power gave a damn what voters wanted. Despite having waged wars in foreign lands to make the world safe for democracy, and despite all the song and bombastic speech about your freedom, they have no respect for your right to self-determination or even their own electoral system. All they care about is getting their own way. And they're willing to engage in the most vile propaganda and blatant manipulation to do so. This is a pitiful excuse for the democracy they claim to love so much. And I'm not sure how long a road it is from here to how Joseph Stalin was quoted in his former secretary's 1982 memoirs. "Comrades, you know," said Stalin, "I think that it's totally irrelevant who votes and how they vote. It's extremely important who counts the votes and how they're counted." Well, we just found out, didn't we? I will have a lot more to say about this in coming shows, because the European Union is such a toxic concoction that I, along with Nigel Farage, can only hope that other countries will see the wisdom of what Britain was able to do last week and do the same thing themselves. I'm not overly optimistic, because so many continental countries simply don't have the tradition of outspokenness and independence of thought that the Brits still seem to have to their credit. But they can see the expanded limits of the possible, and it is up to them to take the bait. Farage is right. This horror story that is the European Union does not only need to eliminate the British. It needs to implode on itself as fast as possible and set the poorer countries free to trade within their own economic parameters and with their own currencies, as before. When I arrived in Singapore from the United States in July 2009, the world was at the height of the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression. Since then, we've seen the US government's debt soar by 70% and the Federal Reserve's balance sheet more than double. We've seen the US government caught red-handed spying on everyone from citizens inside the United States to even their own allies. We've seen an appalling rise in police violence and civil asset forfeiture to the point that the US government now steals more than every thief in America combined. We've seen over 500,000 pages of new bills, rules, and regulations introduced in the land of the free, including some of the dumbest laws of all time, like FATCA. We've seen interest rates held down to near zero in the US and even slashed to negative territory in Europe, Japan, and many other countries around the world. We've seen entire banking systems go bust, like in Cyprus back in 2013, when the national government froze everyone's savings and implemented severe capital controls to bail in the system. We've seen a meteoric rise in the worldwide use of the Chinese renminbi, as well as major direct assaults against the US dollar's global dominance. We've even seen America's own allies openly question why the dollar is still the primary reserve currency in the world. History tells us that wealth and power routinely shift, that major superpowers can and do go bankrupt, that dominant financial systems and reserve currencies can be displaced. Watch out! This comes to you as a warning. In all corners of Europe, opposition to the TTIP has swept like wildfire since the deal was announced in 2013. Huge demonstrations in Paris, Berlin, Madrid, Amsterdam, London, Helsinki, Vienna, Warsaw, Ljubljana and Prague show no sign of ending. In its first year alone, 3,263,920 people signed a petition against TTIP by a London-based charity. Not only do Dutch voters seek a referendum on TTIP, opinion polls make sobering reading on where most Europeans stand. And just to remind you, ladies and gentlemen, TTIP is the so-called trade agreement between the United States and Europe that is the almost exact replica of the TPP, the agreement that we talk so much about between the United States and Asia. Only a few days ago, it was revealed that some 70% of Germans see TTIP as bringing mostly disadvantages. At a time when environmental milestones pointing to irreversible global warming are being reached on a daily basis, the US political leadership's response is to pronounce publicly that it favors environmental resolution while using trade negotiations to assure that effective resolution never takes place. The TTIP draft directive on trade secrets protection is meant to protect companies against the theft of trade secrets. But it has a potential to scope which is too large and threatens to enable lawsuits against people who are not criminals, journalists, trade unionists, or whistleblowers publishing internal information from a company or employees using information acquired in a previous job. The financial raiding of the American middle class is moving full steam ahead. The ridiculous structure of the banking bailouts and artificially low interest rates caused hot money from banks and big investors to crowd out regular families in the housing market. Now here we are, 7 years after the official conclusion of the Great Recession, and regular American families are financially struggling while banks and big investors thrive. Today, 11 million Americans spend half their income on rent. Ladies and gentlemen, did you hear that? Let me repeat that. Today, 11 million Americans spend half their income on rent. Another 21.3 million spent over 30% of their income on rent. With millions of properties being bought by investors since the Great Recession hit, all that has happened is a mega transfer of wealth. You don't build equity by renting, but many people are simply priced out from buying a home. Most Americans have a hard time saving money. This is why housing has been a big plus in the net worth column for so many households for more than a generation. This is seen as a forced savings mechanism. Yet the home ownership rate is at a generational low, and we have a record percentage of families now renting, building no equity. And the big problem in the cities is even more pronounced. So it should come as no surprise that many young Americans stuck in low-wage jobs are unable to rent a place and end up living with parents or roommates. Others simply spend a wild amount of their income on rent. In the past, this would be the prime age to buy, but that is not happening. Unfortunately, there are two big issues here. One, there is a lost decade in home ownership growth, meaning many people missed out on building equity. Two, banks and investors continue to hoard homes, causing an abnormal distortion to the market. This is manipulated because the Fed is forcibly keeping interest rates low. The end result was that investors dived into housing, chasing yields in rental properties, a segment of the market that was largely left to mom-and-pop investors in the past. The amount of buying over the last decade was a new trend, especially with big money flowing in, even though returns are low with 0% interest rates. Banks and big investors had little risk in loading up on rental properties. Rents continue to go up while incomes went stagnant. Rents are going up faster than wages and are far outpacing the overall inflation rate. So it's no surprise that a record number of Americans are spending half their money on rent. This makes it less likely that they are consuming on other goods or also saving for their own retirements. All it means is more money is being siphoned off to banks and investors. This is largely shuffling digital money around, but Americans are now understanding who really has the power in this country. Large financial institutions are dictating how things play out, even if it means things are worse off financially for regular working families. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I think that will do it for today. It is Monday, and therefore you have a week of work, hopefully, ahead. And I will be back with you on Friday at the usual time, same place. This is Richard Martin wishing you a wonderful week ahead. Bye-bye till then.
And there you have it. You decide.